Do you feel it in your own heart, your shoulders, your body? When you connect in with the news, this could feel like a pall, can touch the heart, and it can feel like anxiety, heaviness, worry. So much that's happening in our world right now. So much. And just globally, right? Wow, war. Wars. Not only in Ukraine, but Myanmar, Syria, Yemen. Crisis that calls up. In that particular region, in the lives of people, disrupting people's lives. Now, all this happening within the context of a global pandemic. And then there's the crisis of ecological crisis, climate. And all of that's happening. And there's other things that are happening too. Wonderful things happening in sports and children being born. My uncle was looking at a picture today of my uncle holding his grandchild. My uncle has big hands. He was an athlete. And his whole hand, like taking up the back of this new being, that's his grandson and holding him. And some of you may know JMO, Jessica Mori. Been practicing the Dharma since she was 14 years old at IMS. Came up through the teen retreats, then decided that she wanted to make sure that there were teen retreats for young people. So she created an organization called IBME, Inward Bound Education, Inward Bound Mindfulness Education. She just had a little boy, Connor. There's a picture of him that she sent her friends of him just totally blissed out. Maybe he just ate. Maybe both blissed out. And then there's us here connecting in a Dhamma together, practicing, reminding our hearts. This beautiful practice, remembering. What calls us? What's trustworthy? What is it that we find in this practice that is trustworthy? Resting the heart there, coming together in Sangha, seeing each other, connecting. The sounds of our immediate environment happening in the moment. There's this heater that's running right now. This cup next to me. Everything, all the things that are happening in the world right now, in our lives, the painful, the pleasant and pleasurable, the gain, the neutral. And I thought during this zeitgeist that we're in, it'd be helpful to cultivate the Brahma Viharas as a form of wise attention, right? Some of you were at the last day long that we had here at Marin Sangha, where we worked with wise mindfulness or wise attention and used the awakening factors as a means to cultivate wise attention. And wise attention is very simple. We direct our attention in such a way that we arouse and sustain the wholesome, the beautiful kusala. Very recently, was teaching with someone who defined it as that which is shining. Beautiful. We're turning our heart and orienting towards the shining, the beautiful, the skillful, the wholesome. Wise attention helps us to do that. Just by virtue of through intention, turning the attention towards those things that arouse the wholesome. And then with wise attention, we end up starving the unwholesome, abandoning, and through starving, abandoning the unwholesome, the unskillful, Yeah, it feels really important. A vital to remember and to practice and to deepen our capacity to love during global greed and cruelty and injustice. Like reaffirming for ourselves and each other because we are Sangha, we are humans, and we, as humans, we carry each other in our hearts. So reaffirming for ourselves and each other that love, by love, I'm talking about the Brahma Viharas, I'm talking about metta, friendliness, benevolence, karuna, compassion, mudita, altruistic joy, sympathetic joy, resonating joy, upekkha, equanimity, that reaffirming for ourselves that the beauty, the ethics, the righteousness of love, and reaffirming for ourselves our capacity and our ultimate innate need for love during these times. Vital. Vital to remember and vital to practice. So usually when we are practice the Brahma Viharas, there's a particular order in which we practice them. Metta followed by karuna, mudita, upekkha. And when we cultivate the Brahma Viharas in this standard order, we start to tune into like the specific tone of each one. So it was really interesting to just sit and listen to some of the conversation that was happening at the beginning and to hear Vita talking about being gifted a ukulele. I just love that word, ukulele, ukulele, ukulele. I have a teacher who uses a really fun image for the Brahma Viharas as that of a ukulele. And that each of the four strings represents a Brahma Vihara. And that when we take up each of the Brahma Viharas in the particular order singly, and we feel into the specific tone of each one, so metta, this friendliness. I love that Anushka Fernandopoul talks about metta as this unstoppable friendliness. It speaks to loving no matter what the conditions are, or this friendliness, or this warmth, or sometimes it can just manifest as like there's no ill will. May not feel all that much warmth towards you, but I don't wish you any harm. So metta can be this range, can be this gamut. Feeling into the tone of metta and getting to know like, how does that feel in the body? What are the different states that may accompany metta? There may be gratitude or an energetic uplift or freshness. And then there's feeling into karuna, touching into dukkha, pain. And then the heart, wishing to alleviate that dukkha, that pain, may not be able to, but there's the wish. And if the conditions support it, well, then we can actually move in with compassionate action. But all comes out of this wish. Like, I see the pain, not afraid of it. I'm here, I'm present with it, touching in, wanting to alleviate, soothe. With words and actions. And mudita. I was recently teaching a retreat. And for whatever reason, everyone started saying mudita. We'd write it on the board of like, who's going to lead mudita? They would spell it Moodita. And it feels appropriate because it's delightful. There's levity in it, and it's this happiness that comes from resonating with someone else's good fortune, their beautiful qualities, their success. It's the pride with which a mama like looks on her young person who's like her child, who's like really moving into their gifts and their strengths. Mudita and upekkha, balance. Like we're at a fulcrum, and there's this balance between the ups and downs of life, these eight worldly winds, and standing steady in the middle of it all. And as maybe you can hear as these qualities land in your own heart, maybe you can feel the pleasant tone, how soothing they are, how pleasurable it is to allow our heart, mind, and body to rest in each of these Brahmaviharas. Actually choose one, really get to know it, cultivate it, and feel how it like ripples through the heart and mind, what it feels like, what it tastes like. And these Brahmaviharas are relational. There are qualities that connect us to each other, connect us to ourselves, help us to have an easeful relationship with ourselves, whatever conditions we find ourselves in. Whether it's one of just a neutral and there's metta, there's a really difficulty, a lot of challenge. There's the compassion that can arise. We find ourselves in really fortunate circumstances. We can relate to ourselves with mudita or relate to our good fortune with gratitude or equanimity, like chaos of the world. I'm like, okay, this is how it is. This is the way it is. Tuning to that. And steady like a mountain. Brahmaviharas, they connect us, they're relational. This is from our beloved Thich Nhat Hanh, who is still with us, even though he's not in this realm anymore, still with us. It's a really beautiful teaching that he offered his friends and his disciples before he died, long before he died. He said, when I'm gone, I will still be here, but, and I'm paraphrasing, but it won't be that easy to see me. So you'll have to really pay attention to see me. I'll be the face of a flower. Or the wind. So he's still with us, reminding us that we're connected and that we're connected through these relational practices. Not a relational practice, we're related to each other just by virtue of being alive and being human, but also through our heart's capacity to love through these four beautiful qualities, these Brahmaviharas. So he says, one autumn day, while walking in a park, I became absorbed in the contemplation of a very small and beautiful leaf in the shape of a heart. It was turning red and barely hanging on to the branch, about to fall. I spent a long time with this leaf, asking it a lot of questions. I discovered that the leaf had been a mother to the tree. Usually we think of the tree as the mother and the leaves as her children. But contemplating the leaf, I could see that the leaf was also a mother of the to the tree. Since a leaf is linked to the tree by a stem, the communication between them is easy to see. We are like that leaf. Can you see the link between you and me? If you are not there, I am not here. That is certain. If you do not yet see it, look more deeply, and I am sure you will see it. Since a leaf is linked to the tree by a stem, the communication between them is easy to see. We are like that leaf. What's the stem that connects us? Brahmaviharas, the act of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. We are like that leaf. Can you see the link between you and me? If you are not there, I am not here. That is certain. We carry each other in our hearts. We make each other in our hearts, in our heart minds, if you'd like. We carry each other in our hearts just to be able to experience each other. This becomes really evident when you contemplate the sense gates. There are all these conditions that allow us to see. So there's a play of light and form and color and electrical impulses. So light is actually just electromagnetic waves. And in this moment, light is hitting your computer screen, the light in the form of these electromagnetic waves, illuminating your computer screen. And the light bounces off the screen and hits your eye. And it passes through the lens. It gets focused by the lens of the eye and is sent back to the retina, where there are these rods and cones, and the rods and cones are stimulated. And that light is somehow transformed into electrical impulses that are sent to the occipital region of the brain, where by some mystery that we don't quite understand, that electrical impulse is turned into an image that is constructed in your heart mind. In order to experience another person, in order to experience you, you enter my heart, where I construct you through the sense gates. To experience each other, you literally are reconstructed in the other person's heart mind. We carry each other in our hearts. Since a leaf is linked to the tree by a stem, the communication between them is easy to see. We are like that leaf. Can you see the link between you and me? If you are not there, I am not here. That is certain. If you do not yet see it, look more deeply, and I am sure you will see it. So since we exist in each other's hearts, we've got to make our hearts healthy for each other. Just ensuring that our hearts are a safe space and a refuge, not only for ourselves, but for each other. This evening, we'll be exploring and practicing with the Brahmaviharas, reaffirming our commitment to love through the Brahmaviharas, no matter what. So back to my teacher's analogy of the ukulele and the Brahmaviharas. So in order to tune a ukulele in a holistic way, the strings need to be tuned. They also tune to each other, very similar to a guitar, ukulele guitar. We'll stick with the ukulele because it's got four strings like the four Brahmaviharas. And similarly, we tune the Brahmaviharas to each other. They actually play really well together. It's not these like standalone little silos of like, oh, here is metta, Now I'm compassionate. Here's equanimity. It's not like that. It's not like that. That's one of the reasons I love spending time with people who have been practicing for a really long time, because you feel their heart and their being. One of the Brahmaviharas may be taking a lead, but you feel the other Brahmaviharas there. As I was saying about Tuwari, she is strong. And her strength comes from her mudita, her joy, her capacity to delight in beauty, her capacity to celebrate and tune into another person's good fortune, celebrate it. And there's a strength. And she's compassionate. All held in this friendliness. So the Brahmaviharas is tuned to each other. You think about it, equanimity without compassion can feel really cool, distant, aloof. Metta and mudita without compassion lose their depth and can start to feel Pollyannish. An image that's been coming to me during these really sobering times is, yeah, really sobering. Really sobering. I think Dickens really was on to something when he was describing the French Revolution at the beginning of The Tale of Two Cities. He says it was the best. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of, because it feels so much like our own time. It feels like he was describing the zeitgeist of the French Revolution. And in doing that, he's describing what it's like now, the spirit of our own times. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief, the epoch of incredulity. And that can go both ways, right? We get so entrenched in our views. We can also have beliefs that help us transcend into something that's larger than ourselves. And then the epoch of incredulity is like sometimes you hear the news and you're like, what? What? Just disbelief, the epoch of belief, the epoch of incredulity, as a season of light, a season of darkness. It was the spring of hope and the winter of despair. Such both sobering. So an image that's been coming up for me around this is with the Brahmaviharas, is equanimity at the center, spreading wide, moving into sharing its gift, sharing its wisdom, all of its energy into compassion and mudita, all held in this field of metta. And it almost feels like metta is this energetic field that's holding and protecting equanimity, compassion, and mudita, sympathetic joy. So, wanting to turn to equanimity, compassion, sympathetic joy. Explore that. And if we have time, practicing together, we'll see how it goes. So when sympathetic joy and compassion are balanced, and by balanced I mean And compassion, when we're cultivating compassion, the heart mind doesn't fall into despair, it doesn't fall into overwhelm, it doesn't fall into fatigue when it touches and is in touch with dukkha, challenging the painful. And when we're cultivating mudita, sympathetic joy doesn't fly into exhilaration and exuberance, and it doesn't sink into envy or jealousy when we're connecting with another person's success. And this balance within compassion and sympathetic joy, and this is just my opinion, is due to some measure of equanimity. There's some flavor of equanimity present in both. And there's this, with equanimity, there's this rooted mountain-like harmonious settled this is what comes to mind, just this, there's this understanding that comes from having perspective. So equanimity or upekkha, it's translated sometimes, equanimity, also has this connotation of looking over, getting some perspective, seeing how things have come to be through this eagle eye perspective that sees like, okay, those set of people given this time and this, the politics that are happening and what's going on with climate, like, oh, I see how this came to be. All these conditions coming together, these very fluid circumstances coming together, creating some very fluid outcome. And then remembering that that fluid outcome is just going to become another condition that plays with and connects with other conditions, resulting in some very fluid outcome. And on it goes. This is what animates our lives. Conditionality, dependent arising. And equanimity helps us to see dependent arising. Like, oh, these are the conditions. Seeing how things have come to be. It's one of the reasons I really love reading Toni Morrison. It's like in my late 20s and my early 30s, and was heartbroken and indignant and just wanted to know, like, how did this whole race thing come to be? And all of our collective patterns around it, like, how did this come to be? I remember I had this dream and I asked her about this, and she wrote me this very long letter. And I remember reading the letter and being really satisfied with her answer and feeling very calm, very soothed. And then when I woke up, I forgot what the letter said. I was totally heartbroken. And then it took me a while. I'm embarrassed to say it took me 2 years after that dream to recognize, oh, she's already written the letters. The letter are her books. So just continue to read her books, sweetheart, and you will come to understand how things have come to be around this issue of race. And it's her perspective, right? I trust her perspective. And you see in All Mercy, very slim volume, beautiful book, very spacious, atmospheric, nothing like jazz where the paragraphs on the page are like, they almost look like they're tight, they're constructed, concrete, like the city of New York in which the story actually takes place. A Mercy is very spacious, ephemeral, etheric. And you see in there that this concept of race is in its infancy. It's a modern idea, hasn't been around all that long. She talks about this idea having a serviceability, usability that helps consolidate power for a group of people. So in reading Morrison, it's been helpful to see like, oh, this is how conditions have come to be. These issues of race feel really personal, but they're not. They are not. And you see like all the conditions, and then you see underlying all these conditions of like, yep, put some greed, put some aversion, put some delusion in there around issues of race. And voila, you get systemic racism that is deeply entrenched and keeps on rolling and feeding, reinforced. So with this understanding that we get from having a perspective, an eagle's eye on the situation, and seeing like, ah, not personal. All these conditions coming together that I have pretty much no control over. Because if we did have control over any of this, like systemic racism would be abolished, there'd be no global pandemic, all these wars would be ended, right? But we come to see like, oh yeah, not personal, and not personal because I can't control any of it. And with this understanding comes some like this Tatra Majatata, standing in the middle of things. Like, okay, can I just still intimate with life, totally balanced, feeling the joy, feeling the sorrow blow through us. And we're there, totally intimate, in touch, balanced, recognizing not personal. But it's a learning. The heart needs to mature in relationship to this understanding of seeing the conditions and how things have come to be. And doing this, I feel like the seeing how things have come to be while still being in touch, connected, intimate with all of life, the eight worldly winds that are blowing through, that as we mature in our understanding of how things have come to be, upekkha, equanimity, it helps us to relax our preferences. We don't get rid of them, but we just don't insist that reality conforms to our wants, our likes, our dislikes. With the untrained mind, moments where my mind is like, there's no equanimity, when reality is not conforming to my likes, or my wants, my preferences, there's fear, anger, resentment, despair, grief. And when things do go my way, there's elation and exuberance, and the underlying movement of all of that, greed. Let's just call it greed. You know, equanimity, totally in touch with life. And it's important to know that this is a potential that we can live into, an aspiration, even though there are moments where there's reactivity. Like, I know that it's possible for this heart. It was actually really beautiful. The February month-long teaching, and a yogi came in. It's so interesting. You can tell the energy with which, where a yogi is by the energy with it, which they, how they hit the room, like the way they open the door, how their feet hit the floor, how they sit. The energy she came in with was very, she was deep in. He was deep in. And she said, these teachings on equanimity, the guided meditations we've been doing. That I just know that that's possible for me. But you're so clear. And it was a recognition of like, I'm not there yet, but that is possible for this heart and mind. So we don't need to despair or make an enemy of our reactivity as we're cultivating equanimity. Because it takes time to mature into this understanding. It's in the bones understanding. And we see that at the center of our reactivity is usually some beautiful, innocent wish for peace, for belonging, for connection, for happiness. So we don't need to make an enemy of our reactivity. We do want to be clear, like, that's not where we're headed. I love you, sweetheart, and this is not where we're headed. I love you, honey. And in this moment, we're using some restraint because I do not want this reactivity moving into my words, moving into my actions, because I'm going to inflame a situation that is already heart-wrenching, difficult. I'm just going to add more pain to an already challenging situation. So we don't need to, as we mature into equanimity, all of the Brahma Viharas, when we see where the heart is, the ask of the practice is to just bless the reactivity with our love. To guard our hearts with this care, to guard the hearts of others with care. Metta. The heart can learn to rest balanced and at ease and peaceful with the vicissitudes of life, the pain, the pleasure, the neutral. And sometimes I think we struggle with this, with equanimity, because we think being at peace when there's dukkha, especially when injustice is afoot, we think that if I'm peaceful, that means I don't care. That means I'm indifferent or inured to the challenges of the world. That somehow my outrage, my despair is commiserate with the depth of care. And that's not true. We still care. Like, equanimity is filled with metta. It's still in touch with life. But the care is informed by the wisdom of equanimity that sees again that my reactivity is just going to inflame an already difficult situation. And that the peace of equanimity is the result of this non-reactivity, not leaning into like results with greed and not leaning away by pushing away the reality. Non-reactivity balanced. And when there's that non-reactivity, we can take action that helps to soothe the situation, brings clarity. Helps to soothe the situation, right? It's almost like equanimity is a foundation for compassion to arise. There's enough freedom within our heart and mind that the action that we take, the words that we take are informed by compassion. So the proximate cause for arousing equanimity is recognizing that at a crossroad, I'm wondering whether to move into this peace or move to compassion and mudita. Okay. So the approximate cause for the arising of equanimity is recognizing that our own hearts, our dear ones, our friends, people we don't know, people that we have a challenging time with, that all of us, our ultimate happiness, and by happiness, I'm talking liberation, talking about a heart free of greed, aversion, and delusion, that our liberation is contingent upon our intentions and our actions. So with equanimity, we're starting to turn the heart towards calma. We're letting the heart mature in relationship to this truth of calma. Calma is translated as action. I like to think of it as intention, an impulse. So what's the impulse? What's the intention that's at the center of our thoughts, our words, our actions? Is there a delighting in someone's good fortune, or is there envy? Is there the wish to soothe, to calm, to alleviate pain, or is there passive aggressiveness? Is there friendliness or ill will? Is there letting go? Is there generosity, or is there avarice, greed, rapaciousness? And this turning towards calm is expressed in the Visuddhimagga with the phrase, my happiness. And remember, happiness, in my opinion, not in the suttas, because we're talking Visuddhimagga. But my happiness, my ultimate freedom, my liberation is dependent on my intentions and my actions, not on my wishes for myself, not if someone likes me. Not if that person hates me. Not on I got what I wanted, I didn't get what I wanted. On my wholesome and unwholesome intentions. And recognizing that that we're planting seeds with these intentions that are at the center of our thoughts, our emotions, our words, and our actions. And that when all three of these things, our inner world movements within there, our inner world, our thoughts and our actions are animated by the wholesome, there are wholesome results. And that when they're animated by the unwholesome, there are unwholesome results. And this is very sobering, sobering reflection. The first time I heard this, I was like, how am I living my life? How are you living your life, Dawn Nicole? It was such a wake-up call. It was almost like cold water being splashed in my face. And this doesn't mean that everything that we experience as painful or pleasurable or pleasant or neutral is the result of karma. The Buddha talked about eight causes, and one of those eight causes is karma. So there are seven others, and this is from the Samyutta Nikaya. This is Master Gotama. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who hold such a doctrine in view as this. Whatever a person experiences, whether it be pleasant or painful, or neither painful or pleasant, all that is caused by what was done in the past. What does Master Gotama say about that? Here's the Buddha. Remember, he's talking to us. Some feelings arise here, originating from bile disorders, phlegm disorders, wind disorders, imbalances of the three, so those four are biology. By change of climate, by careless behavior, by assault. And then karmic action. And then he ends this teaching with this poem, and he says, bile, phlegm, and also wind, imbalances, and climate too. Carelessness and assault, and with comma result as the eighth. So the gender discrimination we're seeing with families with transgender youth in Texas right now, that's not the result of some past actions that those families have done. That's assault. the citizens of Syria and Yemen and Myanmar and the Ukraine and all the devastation and the violence that they're experiencing is the result of careless behavior and assault that's being visited upon them. We don't want to use comma to ascribe blame in the present moment for actions that were done in the past. What we're wanting to do is we want to use comma as this sobering reflection that galvanizes us to take beautiful, skillful, shining, wholesome, kusala actions in the present to support liberation. There's so much more to say about compassion and sympathetic joy and how equanimity fills them, balances them, shares its, her, his, their wisdom and beautiful qualities to help them stay in balance. Perhaps we can talk about that the next time we're together. If anything, I guess I want to share, encourage all of us, this is really for myself, not to give up on love, to reaffirm our commitment to living into the wholesome when we're surrounded by so much confusion and the pain that comes out of that confusion. I'm looking at the spine of a book that my computer is resting on. And it's Amanda Gorman's, you know who Amanda Gorman is, a wonderful poet. She has this book, Call Us What We Carry. What is it that we want to carry? The wholesome, the beautiful, metta, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity. Call us what we carry. All supported by turning our attention to that which supports the arising of these beautiful heart qualities that are innate. They're here. They're just waiting for us to call them forward. Use our attention in such a way that they're not only aroused, but they grow in power and strength, filling our words and our actions. Blessing wherever we go. Blessing ourselves, blessing whomever we have contact.